Greetings. It's 1 o'clock and time to jump. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today we'll be talking with one of the leading sociologists in America about the state of capitalism, about socialism, and the environment. Should be a wonderful show, so please join us. But before we go to our guests, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. As newspaper staffs have shrunk, so has newspaper union membership. But a recent organizing effort at a Bay Area startup may show a new path to growing union ranks. Staffers at the Bay Citizen in San Francisco voted in May to join the Pacific Media Workers Guild, a local of the Newspaper Guild Communications Workers of America. The National Labor Relations Board certified the vote this month. Staffers at the year-old nonprofit independent online news outlet said they wanted to set an example for quality journalism and democracy in the workplace. Staff reporter Aaron Glantz said the value of journalists has fallen as traditional media outlets lay off staff in large numbers, and new media outlets aggregate content without paying writers. Glantz said journalists should be able to focus on reporting the news instead of worrying about job cuts, and that includes journalists in new media as well.
We journalists need to be able to buy a house. We need to be able to think about saving to send our children to college. That's very important not only to our lives as journalists, but also in terms of having experienced journalists out there that can keep the public informed of what's going on in this country.
Glantz said staffers at the Bay Citizen have no major grievances with management, but are simply looking to protect themselves over the long term.
Bay Citizen management right now is very committed to investigative and explanatory journalism of the highest order. Our deciding to affiliate with the Guild is not in any way an indication of any conflict here. What it's an indication of is the fact that, you know, we know that our management team may not be forever. We may get a new management team with a different idea, and we want to make sure that if something like that happens, that we have a voice in the process.
Now that Bay Citizen workers have a collective voice, Glantz says the next step is to decide what to say with that voice. He thinks their bold move to unionize, especially with a collegial workplace environment, may inspire other new media outlets to do the same.
On the whole, media workers are pretty scared right now. Everyone is worried about being the next one to lose their job. So I think that journalists from these other outlets may be watching us to see how it goes and could potentially copy it in the future.
To check out the reporting at the Bay Citizen, visit baycitizen.org.
AT&T has been making the rounds in the news this week, though not in the most favorable light. According to recently filed disclosure reports examined by watchdog group Media Matters for America, the company spent a whopping $4.9 million on lobbying in the second quarter of 2011. That's a 58% increase from the same time last year. And T-Mobile, the carrier that AT&T is looking to take over, nearly doubled its lobbying expenses. The carriers have also invested heavily in outside firms, spending an additional $1.3 million there. But it's not just the army of lobbyists that the company has built that has raised eyebrows. And yes, it's quite an army. AT&T hired 90 new lobbyists last year. It's who makes up the ranks. The company has hired powerful former senators, like former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott and former Senator John Breaux, who served on the congressional committee that regulates telecommunications, as well as former Representative Billy Towson, who served on the House Commerce Committee. Former Representatives Don Dellums, Vic Fazio, and Jim Davis have also been contracted to lobby on the proposed merger between AT&T and T-Mobile. While the lobbying news has turned the heads of many consumer groups fighting against the merger, it is AT&T's newly proposed data pricing plans that has the majority of the public's attention and frustration. The company's unlimited data pricing just got, well, limited. AT&T announced this week that it will begin to throttle network speeds for, quote, heavy users, defined as those within the top 5% of data usage who are on the company's unlimited data plan. While their press release asserts that most users will not be affected by these changes, groups like the Future of Music Coalition have pointed out that the proliferation of streaming mobile music applications like Pandora, RDO, and Spotify make it easy for people to go over their data limits. AT&T claims that even with these changes, it will not be sufficient to address the spectrum scarcity and network capacity issues that the company claims to experience. According to AT&T, only the acquisition of T-Mobile will provide a solution to these problems.
Now, who's got who not? You tell me who's blocked from the iPhone 4. Who profits from the stock? Who gets the bill shot? Whose coin gets robbed? T-Mobile customers getting thrown like a rock. The same old script. AT&T lobbies to get big. Verizon probably gonna buy up Sprint. Guaranteed.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, joining you this August Sunday in 2011. Our guest today is one of the most distinguished and accomplished scholars in the field of sociology. He's a political economist and an environmentalist. He's John Bellamy Foster from the University of Oregon, where he's also the editor of Monthly Review, a prominent socialist magazine based out of New York that is now in its 62nd year, if I'm not mistaken. John Bellamy Foster, for full disclosure, is a good friend of mine. I've written many articles with him, and I've worked with him periodically at Monthly Review. Professor Foster, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, Bob. Good to be on Media Matters again.
Well, let's get right into it, John Foster. You write a lot about economics and political economy and the state of capitalism in the United States and the world today. And for much of this summer, there have been debates in Washington between the various political parties, the two political parties specifically, the Obama administration, some recalcitrant Democrats on the left fringe of the party, or the heart of the party, perhaps, and then the Republicans over how to deal with the current economic crisis. If they were to all call you up and say, John Bellamy Foster, explain the nature of the crisis of capitalism, what are we missing in our debates here? What would you tell them?
Well, the first thing is that this is a very severe crisis, and so it was a long time coming into being. When we have a severe crisis, we understand that it's due to structural features that that go way back. And the beginning of these economic problems go back to the early 1970s, well, actually mid-1970s, 74, 75, around then when we had a major economic crisis. And in the period 73 to 75, in particular, the U.S. economy and the world economy slowed down the growth rate. And it never got back to the growth rate that existed in the 1960s. And so in the United States and the other advanced capitalist economies, rate of growth was higher in the 1960s than in the 1970s, higher in the 1970s than in the 1980s and 90s, and higher in the 1990s than in the first decade of the 2000s. So the rate of growth of the economy has been slowing down. And in this context, in order to keep the economy going, or as part of promoting economic growth has been a shift towards financialization and speculation, which has in some ways boosted economic growth but has created other problems, bigger and bigger financial crises, greater distortions of the economy, and so on. So we're in a kind of stagnation financialization trap. We could make the whole thing more complicated by bringing in the world economy, but I'll stop with that at the moment. So this is the problem that has to be dealt with, is slowing down of the economy and the shift towards the financialization. However, most of the discussions now are focusing on the federal deficit, which is not the problem. In fact, right now it would help if the government expanded its spending in terms of the promotion of the overall economy.
You're John Foster, along those lines, when I listen to the current debates in Washington between the Obama administration and the Republican Party and the Republican leadership, it's striking to me that they both seem to be arguing, for lack of a better term, what Andrew Mellon and Herbert Hoover were debating in the Depression, those sort of solutions, which I think for a lot of us who studied economics, mainstream economics, like you and I did together in the 1970s, it's almost surreal that they're reliving sort of an economic policy debate that at one time was regarded as thoroughly discredited, yet now is the new orthodoxy.
Yeah, all of the neoliberal forms of argument, monetarism, the various conservative economic strategies all involve cutting back on government spending, cutting back on wages, all the things that Keynesian economics told you you shouldn't do in a crisis. And yet this is the emphasis now. And it would be completely irrational, I think, the way we learned economics, you and I and everybody from our generation in the Keynesian period, this would have been considered a completely irrational. There is a explanation for it, though, I think, and that's the shift towards financial domination has also led to fiscal conservatism, and so that just as the private economic interests are involved heavily in speculation, they want the government to be fiscally conservative and to divert the revenue streams towards them. They want the value of money defended. They're more worried about inflation than they are about employment. So we have an emphasis within the economy that's geared to the needs of financial interests and the very rich. They're not really concerned about whether the economy as a whole grows. That's not their top priority. Their top priority is the value of their own assets. They're concerned with asset promotion, that is the promotion of their wealth and not the promotion of employment and the economy.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is John Bellamy Foster, professor of sociology at the University of Oregon, editor of Monthly Review Magazine, a socialist magazine out of New York that was begun in 1949 by Paul Sweezy and Leo Huberman. And he's joining us today on the phone. We recorded this show a little over a week before going on the air at the end of July. So don't call in today. Sit back, relax. Let us do the yakking. John Bellamy Foster writes widely on political economy, on capitalism, and on the environment, one of the leading environmental sociologists and writers in the world. We'll be talking about all those issues today. I hope you'll enjoy the program with us. John Bellamy Foster, going back to the state of the economy in the United States today, we've been talking about the sort of policy toolkit being the sort of the legitimate range of debate, which is almost all just how much cutbacks there will be in spending that might benefit the great bulk of the population, and the premise that the deficit, at least in the surface, the premise that this is the cause of all economic problems, and if we balance the budget, then the economy will grow again. What would you say if you could say this is what people who really care about democracy and a healthy, vibrant economy right now, what are the sort of things that those people should be working for, if not for a balanced budget and cutting Social Security and Medicare?
Well, the federal deficit is the major issue in the country because there's this absurd law that exists where they have to, Congress has to separately pass an increase in the deficit, and so they're having a huge debate about that. And the Democrats have gone over to this conservative economic philosophy as well. So there seems to be a general consensus that in the power circles that the budget has to be restricted, which is what all economics for most of the post-Second World War period taught you not to do in a recession. If you look at the deficit, the federal deficit, why has it increased recently? It's increased for two or three reasons. One is the economic recession itself, that as the economy slows down, the revenue to the government from income tax shrinks. And so without spending increasing, with spending still at the same level, the deficit will rise. Another thing is the government did do some things that increased the deficit in combating the economic crisis. Not so much things that help the working population, but the audit of the GAO just carried out of the Federal Reserve showed that this was just in July. The GAO showed that the Federal Reserve fondled $16 trillion in the form of loans and other forms of financial support to the largest financial institutions and corporations. This is a report of the U.S. government, and obviously this had an effect on the deficit. And then the increase in military spending with two or three wars going on, depending how you count them, this all had an effect on the deficit too. So these are causes of deficit increase that have nothing to do with the government spending money to help the general population on things like schools or health or anything like that. If you look at Social Security and Medicare, they're paid for out of payroll taxes, out of regressive payroll taxes, and Social Security has been producing a surplus for years. It's still in the black. Medicare is in a little bit more difficult situation, but these programs are the strongest part of the federal finances, while they're being blamed. And, of course, they're the things that help the population the most. They're primarily transfer payment programs. And even Obama now has done what no Democrat has done before, is to really push for cuts in Social Security and Medicare. They had this old notion that only Nixon could go to China, meaning only a Republican set up a new relationship with Red China, because the Republicans were on the right. The same principle applies to the Democrats and Social Security. Only a Democrat could really cut substantially Social Security, a Democratic president. If a Republican was in an office, the Democrats would stop that completely. So we're in this terrible situation where there's this huge crisis. They've decided they want to balance the federal budget, and the reason they're in such bad shape now is because of money that went to the rich or went for warfare. Even in historical terms, though, the deficit isn't that big relative to the Second World War. Instead of facing up to this situation, they're going to make the population as a whole pay for it all. And if people think they're suffering now, they're going to be suffering even more later if they let this go through.
Our guest, John Bellamy Foster. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We pre-recorded this show about 10 days or so before going on air, so please don't call in. Sit back, relax, let us do the talking. John Bellamy Foster is a professor of sociology at the University of Oregon, an economist, environmentalist who writes widely on the matters we're talking about today. And John Foster, one of the things along these lines that's striking about the current debates is that by the various figures I've seen, right now, business and the wealthy are sitting on roughly $1.5 to $2 trillion in capital that they're not investing. That's sort of on the sideline, that's being parked. These are the people who are deemed the job creators by Speaker of the House John Boehner. And the argument goes that they don't have enough money still. We need to keep taxes low so they will have even more money to invest. But they're not investing the money they have now. I mean, there's literally $1.5 trillion at least, maybe $2 trillion, that corporations and individuals have on the sidelines, not being invested in plants and equipment, not creating jobs. And why isn't that money being invested? Why is it on the sidelines?
Well, that reminds me of something I didn't say in answer to the last question, and that is another reason for the deficit is the fact that we've been cutting taxes on the rich. And as you cut taxes on the rich, you have to borrow money. The federal government has to borrow money to make up for the loss of the revenue, and they end up borrowing from the rich.
So the rich get to lend their money instead of paying taxes, which isn't a bad deal. Who wouldn't like that? I'd rather lend my money to the government and get interest back than have to pay taxes.
Yeah, exactly. So that's another reason why the deficit is so big. But so we've been giving all of this money back to the wealthy and to corporations, and that increases the cash they have available or the economic surplus that they have to dispose. Right now, they're sitting on a billion or more
trillion
dollars. I mean, trillion or more dollars in cash, and these are figures that are widely known now, that and $1 trillion in cash, and they're not investing it. Now, if you ask any economist what the fundamental cause of economic crisis is, they're going to say they're going to basically agree that the problem, the reason for economic slowdowns, is a lack of investment. Now, they're all going to disagree about why there isn't any investment. But it's fundamental that if you don't have new capital formation, the economy doesn't grow. Now, the corporations are sitting on $1 trillion in cash, and they're not investing it. And some of it, they're sort of speculating with. When we say cash, it means various easy to get funds, but this isn't being put into expanding productive capacity in the economy, which would employ more people. Rather, they consider that too risky, and the reason it's too risky is because there are all sorts of problems of market saturation, lack of effective demand, and so on. And a large part of this problem, this lack of effective demand, has to do with the fact that the economic demand coming from working people is so weak. Real wages have stagnated for around 40 years now. And so real wages haven't been increasing in the United States, and working people basically keep their consumption up by relying on larger amounts of debt, but that's tied into the whole financial crisis. That strategy has evaporated, and so there's a weakness of effective demand for this and other reasons. Corporations also, they don't invest if they don't think there's going to be a demand in the future, and if they have a lot of unused productive capacity, they think capital formation is too risky, so they decide to speculate with their money instead. So we have this situation. There was really a very, very weak investment in the United States, and really no net investment. So the economy is sluggish for that reason.
John Foster.
And that's a disaster, what we call an accumulation crisis.
John Foster, let me just follow up on this point, because this is straight ahead Keynesian economics. These are the issues that have Paul Krugman and Robert Reich and Joe Stiglitz's heads exploding, and everything they've been writing for the last 2 years about our economy. Every step being taken in Washington by the politicians at this point, with the exception of a little bit of stimulus done in 2009, has been all about diminishing demand for products, aggravating the problem, making it worse. I mean, is there any way out? To a listener of ours who's 21 or 22, is this 1930 for them? Is there any way out of this impasse? Is there any way we're going to have growing incomes and an unemployment rate in this country at 3 or 4 or 5% in the visible future?
No, I don't think there is any chance that there's going to be that rate of growth in the visible future. Even in the mainstream, they're hoping for what they call a respectable rate of growth, which is 2.5%. But that's not enough to, a long-term 2.5% rate of growth isn't enough to prevent unemployment from increasing. There's no one really has expectations of the kind of economic growth that existed before. I think that we often fall into the notion that those who are running the economy, I mean those who really have power, the CEOs who run the corporations, the corporate rich, the government elites, and so on, that their interest is primarily in promoting the employment of the overall population, or even the growth of the overall economy. And I think that we're running into a situation where these things are less important to those people in power than the growth of their own wealth. They're more and more tied into the international economy, more tied into finance. And the fact that employment is higher is not necessarily a negative. So we have to remember that those who are in charge are not really trying to alleviate this problem necessarily. Their profits are doing well, and as long as that's true, then they tend to think the situation is fine.
Well, John Foster, it's always been true that there's been a tension among the investors, the corporations, that on one hand, they want low wages, so unemployment's not a bad thing if it keeps their labor costs down. On the other hand, though, they need people to buy their products so they can expand. And so they like high wages, at least for all the workers except their own, to the extent it means they can sell more of their product. Am I hearing you say basically that in that equation, the sentiment or the interest among those corporations and wealthy investors that see they have great advantages by having a well-paid, employed working class that's buying their products is just a lot less now than the interest of those who don't really see any advantage to that, see advantages to having other things?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're pursuing a high profit margin strategy that basically the wealth, the profits, the wealth come from the difference between the price of the product and what's paid for prime production costs, primarily the wages of production workers. And I mean, it's a lot more complicated than that, but the fundamental thing is to keep labor costs down and maximize profits in that way. They're not so interested in that's the strategy they're adopting rather than a strategy that maximizes employment and so on. They're increasing the profit margins or rate of exploitation in Marxian terms by also expanding their production globally and relying on low wage labor in the third world, so their profit margins are enormous. The main problem they face is they have a problem of markets. That is, they have a problem of selling goods. And this is what they're continually coming up against. But it doesn't seem to change the strategy. The strategy is to push down wages everywhere across the entire globe.
But John Bellamy Foster, your argument economically, as I understand it, is that unlike the conventional wisdom or reasoning, I should say, and analysis, which is that the economy, with healthy policies and patience, the economy ultimately will work out. Good policymaking can lead to high growth, high incomes, and a very successful capitalism. Your argument, as I understand it, is that capitalism is so deeply flawed that there's basically almost impossible to get to a high growth, growing incomes capitalism in the current situation, and that this is sort of deeply inscribed into how the system works.
Yeah, exactly. Realistically, along the capitalist path, there's no way of doing that. You'd have to have a general revolt in the society, a massive, massive revolt of working people, something bigger than the Great Revolt from below in the 1930s to really shift the direction of things. And that's not happening. And then there's the whole problem of the global economy. We have this vast global reserve army now, officially there's 6% unemployment in the world, but that's very misleading, because there are 1.6 billion people that the ILO classifies as vulnerably employed. That is, street workers and subsistence workers, there's 39% of the working population in the world. 39% of the workers get $2 a day or less, and on top of this, there's something like 40% of the working age population in the world is not in the labor forces at all. And so you've got these vast pools of labor of really impoverished people, and they're all being forced to compete against each other under the rule of multinational corporations that are more and more concentrated at the international level. So all of this is very complicated, but it's affecting the U.S. situation too today. And this is the kind of environment that neoliberalism has promoted, where it's basically a race to the bottom globally.
And then this leads to the obvious question, which I think every listener probably has right now, is, okay, well, what do we do? What's the solution? Is there a way out? And before you answer that, I should preface that by saying that I think the general operating wisdom in the United States, virtually all takers, is that any solution has to be done within the framework of capitalism. You have to keep basically the corporations in power and private investment in power and markets intact, and then you just sort of try to come up with policies to make the system work better. You're saying that that isn't really a credible solution given the balance of power in the world today. Is that right?
Yeah, it's not a credible solution. But when you say, well, we have to move away from capitalism, people get a little bit worried, because they think of capitalism as the whole world, and it's like you're asking them to step off the world, and all they see is vacant space out there, and that's understandable. I think that capitalism has to be seen not so much as a space or an entity in this sense, but as a logic. There's a kind of a logic to the accumulation of capital and the kinds of inequality that it generates, the way in which it extracts surplus from the workers and the poor, and concentrates that among the rich, the way in which corporations get bigger and bigger, more powerful. We have to, what we have to do is turn the logic around, and that's what the struggle for socialism is about. Everything has to be a battle for substantive equality, that is real equality, not formal equality of opportunity. We have to shift the logic, but of course we can only do that if we actually rise up and organize and say things don't have to be this way. And in the process of fighting against the logic of capital, we can win all sorts of things for working people. It's not really a question of the increase in productivity or economic growth is not really the question in terms of the conditions of life of most people. It's more, you know, a question of distribution. What do we do with this enormous surplus that we have? So the corporations are sitting on $1 trillion they don't know what to do with, and they're not willing to invest. Well, I think the population of the country, the working people, could tell them what they could do with $1 trillion or what the society could do with it. So this is an absurd situation. And
I mean, just to put that in context,
strike out against it.
$1 trillion in unused capital is equivalent, basically, of the other side of that coin is, you know, 15 million people who aren't working because no one's hiring them, producing something. So you have all this idle wealth, and that's also idle labor.
Exactly.
You know, John Foster,
it's completely irrational to have idle wealth and idle labor at the same time, but that's the irrationality the system promotes.
John Foster, our guest professor of sociology at the University of Oregon. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. John Foster is a political economist and environmentalist. We're talking about the state of the economy, and we'll be talking about the environment shortly. We recorded this program, about a week and a half before we went on air, so please don't call in. Sit back, relax, and let us do the talking. John Foster, most people who even would agree with your critique of capitalism and its limitations and don't like the way the world's going and don't like the quality of life and don't like the future, and even those who see that capitalism undermines democracy by creating so much inequality and giving so much power to those with money, are hesitant to think about the idea of leaving capitalism because they say, well, as bad as capitalism can be or has been or is, you still have civil liberties, you still have individual rights, you still have some freedom to sort of live your life. And in socialist societies, at least the historical record is that you don't have those freedoms, you don't have democracy, you don't have the rights to do stuff. It's more or less a police state. And that's, you know, I'd rather live in capitalism than in a police state if those are my two options. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think anybody in their right mind wants to live in a police state. And I think that there were some societies, the Soviet Union being the number one example, was the product of a socialist revolution in a peripheral poor country. It started out with a very socialist egalitarian orientation, but it morphed into a very oppressive class society where the oppression was came through the state. And I don't think anybody in their right mind wants that kind of situation. But I don't think the Soviet Union at that stage was socialist in any way, shape, or form. If socialism is about substantive equality and the people at the bottom controlling the society, socialism is about an extension of democracy to the economic realm, to the realm of production. It's not about giving up individual liberties and freedoms. So on every factory door, it says no entrance except on business, and that symbolizes the fact that the political realm doesn't have any role really in determining production in our society. It's completely outside of the realm of democracy, and I think we have to extend democracy into those realms. I think that the countries that are raising socialism in the most creative ways in the world today, like Venezuela, understand that, and they're actually shifting not only resources but control towards the population, and that's the kind of society we need.
What do you make of countries like Sweden and Norway and Finland, what are routinely called socialist countries in sort of popular parlance, but I guess are more technically called social democratic countries, meaning they have large welfare states, but they still have private investment? How do you assess those?
Well, I think that the social democratic welfare states, particularly the Scandinavian societies, I mean, certainly they represented gentler forms of and more humane forms of capitalism. And they're certainly more egalitarian than, say, the United States. But those societies in this period under the because of all of the global economic forces that we've been talking about, they're increasingly going in the direction of neoliberalism. State welfare states are eroding in various ways, and it seems like, you know, it's pretty clear that that strategy, which was associated with Keynesianism, no longer is viable. So we either have to have a more radical strategy that basically changes the rules of the game, or we have to we'll just watch those societies turn into increasingly unequal neoliberal states.
Now, in the Latin America, you cited Venezuela, but it too is primarily a poor country with tremendous amounts of poverty relative to Western Europe or North America. Are there examples in similar political economies in the United States in either East Asia or Europe where you're seeing sort of hopeful signs, or is it still primarily the left project to look at what's been called the third world to see that this is the weak spots in the system where change might happen?
Well, in a monthly review that I'm associated with, has always been always seen the third world, seen the poorer countries as the leaders in let's say revolutionary social change, really truly radical rock bottom social change, simply because of the depth of the problems they have to deal with, the depth of inequality and the imperialism that they are confronted with. So revolutions have generally been third world phenomena, but we are seeing an intensification of class struggle in the rich countries now, and things are changing. In Europe, you're seeing a very intense class struggle in Greece and Spain, Portugal, particularly the countries that are being forced to suffering from this fiscal conservatism from neoliberalism and the current crisis. And there's bigger and bigger revolts of the population of the working class in these countries, and I expect this to happen. What is and then that opens up all sorts of new possibilities, and we need a new, more radical political strategy, not simply a social democratic one in these circumstances. In the United States, though, there's still zero strikes. It's quite phenomenal how different the United States is right now from Europe, because revolt in Europe has gone up, and the United States has almost gone down, unless you consider the right-wing Tea Party as a revolt. I think there are all sorts of possibilities, and right now we can see these developing in Europe, but it's only the beginning.
John Bellamy Foster, our guest on Media Matters here on WILL AM 580, a recorded show. Please don't call in. Just let us do the talking. John Foster, much of your work and probably the heart and soul of your research has been on the environment and the ecology. And if you could sum up for listeners unfamiliar with that work, you know, what your key findings are and what people should understand about the environmental crisis that maybe they're not getting from the news media?
Yeah, it's I like to say that the mainstream environment, mainstream environmentalism, or not just environmentalism, the mainstream approach to environmental issues consists of three stages of denial. The first is to an absolute denial of the problem, which is really the straight defense of the corporate bottom line. So that's saying that global warming, for example, or climate change doesn't even exist. And that position is actually heavily funded and supported by corporate capital. So because it means you don't have to do anything at all. It's like the old tobacco companies that said, no, this cigarettes aren't dangerous to your health, and they kept on arguing that forever. So that's the first stage of denial, and in the United States, that absolute stage of denial is very strong. There's a second stage of denial that says, yeah, there is an environmental problem, and environmentalists argue this, but capitalism has nothing to do with it. And then it focuses on things like consumption, the buying of consumers, and then technology, and basically ignores the economy, the issue of capitalism, the production system. There's a third stage of denial, and this has now become very prominent in the environmental movement. And it says, capitalism is the problem, capitalism is also the solution. And so there's no inherent problem within the system that prevents it from solving all of this. And my approach is quite different in that of a lot of sociologists, environmentalists on the left. And I think capitalism is the problem, and the solution has to do with getting rid of capitalism. And this has to do with a whole lot of factors, but one of the things is that capitalism is basically a machine for accumulation. Even with the slow economic growth we have now, it's still a system that's geared to exponential growth, because that's how you accumulate capital. In fact, the reality is the accumulation of capital on ever bigger scale. And this puts greater and greater pressure on the environment without really improving the lives of most people. Even in an narrow economic sense, it undermines the sustainability of the entire planet, which we can now see. And in the process, capitalism also corrupts the entire production system. So we hand out worldwide a trillion plastic bags for free every year, and then these contribute to the degradation of the environment. Completely irrational at every level. The gas mileage, the fuel efficiency of the average car in the United States is less than the Model T Ford. So capitalism is the production system is really the problem. Unless we address that, we won't get out of this trap. The one other thing I would say is that those who want to say that we have an easy ways out try to say the whole problem is simply climate change. But climate change, even though it's a gigantic problem, is only, according to scientists, a small part of the overall environmental crisis, which consists of us crossing all sorts of planetary boundaries, including
acidification,
the ozone layer, running out of water, and so on.
Yeah, John, take a second more, if you would, please, to just elaborate on this threat. Because right now, for a lot of Americans, and I suspect some of our listeners and myself, you hear about, well, there's this ecological crisis and it's climate change, but it's unclear if we're talking about something that is impending doom, like an apocalyptic movie, or something that we can sweep under the rug and let our grandchildren worry about. What are the tangible signs and concerns and that we should have immediately and going forward?
Well, the climate change is a difficult problem because there are what we call feedback mechanisms in the process that speed up the change. And so what seems to be happening slowly then suddenly gathers speed, and pretty soon it's too late to do anything about it. And so climate scientists talk about tipping points. One example is the Arctic Ocean. The ice in the Arctic it's melting very rapidly now, far more rapidly than any past prophecies or past predictions suggested. And as the Arctic ice melts, what you have is a weakening of the albedo effect, reflectivity of the Earth, because white ice is replaced by blue ocean, which means that the planet absorbs more solar energy and the rate of climate change increases. And there are a lot of other feedbacks like that threaten very soon to accelerate the problem. And so you have tipping points. You also have tipping points where after a certain point, let's say melting of the ice in Greenland or Antarctica, West Antarctica, if you after a certain point, it will be too late to stop it. After the melting reaches a certain level, temperatures reach a certain level, melting reaches a certain level, the integrity of the system is gone, and it will go. Whatever we do, it will be too late to stop the melting from continuing. So the problem with climate change is that we for some of these things, and say things like a rising sea level, which is a focus of James Hansen, who's the leading climatologist in the world, the director of NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies. He says that we have he used to say we had a decade in which to act. He now says we have basically years to act. If we, you know, he may be wrong, but he's been right on everything else so far. So if we don't take action pretty quickly, he says it's going to be too late. And I was at a talk that he gave, and somebody said, well, we have to educate the children. The children were there, and so that they can solve this problem. He says, well, by the time they're grown up, it'll be too late to solve some of these things. Of course, it won't all be over, even if sea level rises massively and affects the lives of billions of people and affects the weather systems throughout the world. It's not that we'll all perish immediately, but it is a situation where time is running out, and we will have a series of catastrophes that get bigger and bigger if we don't take action soon. I hope that's clear.
Well, John Foster, you know, I think in the third level of denial, you're talking about that capitalism is the problem, but it also can be the solution, which I think is where a lot of the serious environmental minds are at this point in the mainstream. The argument is that, you know, if you put in very strict environmental guidelines that all capitalists have to play by the same rules, so no one gets a competitive advantage, that you can make the system more ecologically sound, and you can solve these problems as long as you have a public sector, a government that can, you know, stand up and enforce very strict environmental guidelines in sort of the best social democratic manner. I assume that's the argument, and that corporations then won't be penalized by playing along. They'll benefit by it, and ultimately they want to live too, the CEO, so they'll go with the program. I don't know if that's accurate. Tell me if it isn't, but if it is accurate, what's the problem with that argument?
Well, there's so many problems with that argument. It's it's hard to know where to begin, but the standard and argument of coming out of mainstream economics is that the economy externalizes its environmental costs onto nature and society in general. So corporations don't pay the environmental costs of pollution and other forms of environmental destruction. It's all externalized on nature, and nature pays the price, or the public pays the price. And economists said, well, we can solve this and by just internalizing environmental costs so that the system pays for all the costs that it generates, including the costs of pollution and so on. Well, I mean, if you just think about it, in terms of the automobile, what would it take for corporations to internalize all the costs of the automobile? It's absolutely gargantuan. They would immediately go out of business. There's no way they could do that. In that sense, K. William Capp, who was a great environmental economist, said capitalism is a system of unpaid costs. It doesn't really pay the full costs of production, and it can't. And the other thing is that capitalism is geared to perpetual economic growth, and particularly the accumulation of capital, which requires economic growth, profits, which require economic growth. And so it's a system that's geared to an extension all the time, quite apart from the actual quality of life of individuals. The notion is that you make the economy bigger and bigger, and that you have to do this forever, so that if you have a 3% rate of growth in the economy, which was the historical average, the previous historical average, that means that the world output would be 16 times as big in a century, 250 times as big in two centuries, and 4,000 times as big as in three centuries. And they think that's rational. Well, the Earth can't sustain it. It can't do this. And we have to learn that these things are impossible. You can't extend the American form of economy and consumption and living standards to the entire world. We're already exceeding the capacity of the planet. So we have to find an entirely different way, but we can't find a different way within this system. We have to have a different system. It's not that capitalism is all bad. It helped us get to where we are, but it's no longer the solution to the problems that we have today.
It's ironic, isn't it, John Foster, that the original generation of advocates of capitalism, the economists, going back from Adam Smith through the middle of the 19th century, as a rule understood that capitalism was a time-dated system, that it would be here for a while. It had a lot of great things they liked, but eventually it would no longer be of great value and society would move on.
Yeah. Even as late as John Maynard Keynes, he talked about a stationary state at the point where we reached a certain amount of wealth and we could basically then stabilize society and concentrate on the quality of life and distribution issues and so on.
John Bellamy Foster, on that note, I'm afraid the band's tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio for the next show. I want to thank you for joining us today here on Media Matters. It's been an honor and a privilege talking with you.
Thank you. It's been fun.
I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILAM 580. I'll be back with you in 1 week with a live show. Thank you very much, everyone. Have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Another hot, humid day is in the forecast today with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. In fact, that chance of showers and thunderstorms stays with us through Tuesday. Today's high 90. Tonight's overnight low 70. Tomorrow, a high of 85. And on Tuesday, a high near 83. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.